Good morning. This is Keep 106.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine with John Shepherd and Andy Fenton.
Just a little loving early in the morning beats a cup of coffee for starting off the day. Just a little loving when the world is yawning makes you wake up feeling good, things are coming your way.
Hello, and nice of you to join us today. The issues around Weymouth Harbourside have been put under the spotlight by the ill-considered placing of railings along the sea wall. True, there have been improvements to public seating, and the parking ban is largely welcomed. On the downside, bad behaviour in the area at night has raised an ugly issue: racism. A town councillor speaks out about this, and while residents worry that unless yobbish behaviour is stamped out, the pretty harbour will become a no-go area for tourists. Today we share their views. Historian and rail buff Paul Atterbury has the final word about the felling of thousands of mature lineside trees that have concerned listeners in recent months. His take on the subject might surprise you. So what else have we got in the show today, Andy?
Well, remember the rather sniffy outcry when, in the 1980s, Oxfam opened a second-hand clothing shop? It'll never catch on, people said. Well, how wrong they were. Today, old clothes, fashions, and especially trainers are now big business. We have a report on who buys second-hand generally, and what do they buy. Ruth takes us gardening with No Mow May, and we hear about a town council with money to give away to good causes. But we start the show with some sobering thoughts about the appalling after-dark behaviour by young people on Weymouth Harbourside. To recap, the area has changed in recent weeks. Parking has been abolished, and more of the area is being used by cafes and pubs for outside eating and drinking. There's more public seating, and you'd be right in saying, so far, so good. However, not so good are the new railings erected without consultation at a cost in excess of £40,000 by Dorset Council. Many say they are unnecessary and not fit for purpose. But the general improvement to the area has its downside. Large gatherings of youths, up to 200 we've been told, has fostered simmering incidences of racism. Racism in Weymouth? The subject is raised in this interview with Weymouth Town Councillor Tia Ruse. Prepare to be surprised, horrified even, as John talks to her by telephone.
Can we just look at the problems in detail? I mean, what surprised me is that people have talked about racism.
Yeah, there's been reports that some of the incidents that have happened on the harbourside are race-related. And in some ways, I think that is really upsetting to hear, because I can understand that young people are frustrated and that they might cause a few issues in town because they're feeling the after effects of coming out of lockdown, and that they've been, you know, kind of trapped in houses for a very long time, and they've got a lot of energy and thoughts and emotions to deal with. But actually to hear that it was race related was really upsetting. But it is something that has been in the Melcombe Regis area for a very long time. I don't think it's ever gone away, that there are still race, you know, we've always had race related incidences almost every year.
I mean, are we talking about large numbers of people who are not British, shall we say, for the purpose of sympathy? Yes. I'm not aware of the fact that there are a lot of people from other countries living in the area, but it is, perhaps I'm wrong.
Well, you know, the thing is I've had reports, I have to say, they are British, but they are a part of a black and minority ethnic group, and that might mean that they originate somewhere different, or they might have, it can even be that they've always lived in England all of their lives, they have their families, but because certain people aren't are ignorant, and because they're not actually communicating with their communities and understanding of other people who have different cultural backgrounds, or, you know, we all know what racism is, I hope, although it seems some people don't. The big problem is that we've had people who, they might be English and look completely different to somebody and they get racially attacked. Or it might be that they're Polish shop, and they get graffitied. It's always been there. There's always been an issue with people who will want to attack on communities that are not seen as, you know, the white British person. But I think that's really ignorant view.
Now, Malcolm Regis is known, unfortunately, as being one of the poorest areas within one of the poorest areas in the country. Are you saying that in Malcolm Regis there are a lot of people who are not part of, or rather, who have I have to be very careful the way I phrase this.
Yeah, it's a hot topic, isn't it?
you know, shall we say, who are not British, who are from outside our country. So therefore they are foreigners, in inverted commas. Are we saying that in Malcolm Regis there is a large number of people?
Well, Malcolm Regis has the second largest black and minority ethnic group in the whole of Dorset. We had that research done while we had Weymouth and Portland Borough Council. Only that area, it's almost hidden. You know, people aren't very open about it, and it's not discussed enough. And it's almost not tackled enough, because there could be things put in place by different organisations to help break down barriers between communities so that people are mingling and actually, you know, to maybe educate people who are more ignorant around.
I've lived in Weymouth.
Who are different.
I've lived in Weymouth for more than 15 years, and I wasn't aware of this. I mean, has this issue, this racialist issue, been swept under the carpet?
I don't know. To be honest, it's difficult. I know that every year I've had reports that, you know, a council are having to clean up or clear up swastikas from walls, or racist slurs on shop windows, and I just, you know, it gets dealt with, but I don't know if it's talked about enough, or if people just, you know, I think if people are busy all the time and they're working and they're worrying, maybe it's not a topic that's often discussed enough between people in the area. I don't know. I think maybe more research could be done on it. Maybe it's something for the police to pick up and champion, that they're going to look into how to make things more transparent and, you know, build up communication between people and educate, you know. I think, you know, my dad's Dutch, and he's always been really welcomed, actually, in England. You know, he's lived here for over 40 years. He has even a London twang to his Dutch accent. But, you know, I think he's never experienced the kind of discrimination that I'm seeing more and more towards people who are foreign in this country. And I don't know if Brexit has played part in that. I don't know if, you know, it could be education in schools. I think there's a lot of factors that come into play. And it's not just one, you know, one organisation can deal with it. I think it's a multi-organisation thing that needs to be tackled. But it's definitely going to have to come from the Dorset Council end, because they're the ones who sort of have the power and the voice with the police and all the other organisations who would be relevant, to be honest.
Let's go back to the first things we were talking about, which was the Harbourside and bad behaviour. I mean, what has been said to me by local residents is that unless this somehow is cleared up, this bad behaviour, it's going to have a very bad effect on tourism.
Yeah, I think, like, I don't know if it will have as negative an impact as people are concerned about on tourism. I think it's more that there is always going to be antisocial behaviour at times. It's just, you know, we need to come up with public safety protection orders that actually are going to work for the pedestrianisation of the harbourside. And that does take some time and consultation and talking to different organisations. And I know Councillor John Arell, he's actually, you know, spending a lot of time trying to coordinate and work with multidisciplinary organisations to sort of call the bigger, the chance that there is more increased antisocial behaviour, not just racially driven, but just, you know, through people drinking or anything else. But, you know, I think people forget that Weymouth did have a harbour club and a navy, and that they even had their own navy police force that used to patrol the streets because of antisocial behaviour. It's, we've always been a lively town, you know.
Yes. How do you feel about the fact that a lot of the drinking is because people can buy a drink at local off licences and they're not necessarily using the pubs on the harbour side? Somebody made a suggestion to me that, in fact, the local off licences should be closed early in the evening to dissuade people from buying their cans of high-strength lager. So, therefore, if there isn't a supply, then they can't really drink on the harbour side and misbehave late at night.
Unfortunately, that's not going to work because Asda's literally next to the harbour and it's 24-hour. So if you close the off-licence, they'll just walk up to Asda and go buy their alcohol. I think it's more that when we deal with antisocial behaviour, we get down to the root of it. It's often around people's well-being and mental health. And if you imagine everybody's been locked up like caged animals for 3 months, there might be some wild behaviour as people come out of that and they want to express themselves and you know, feel some freedom. But I think at the same time, stopping people from actually being able to drink on a harbour side where people have had drinks for years is not realistic, and it's just I think people are anticipating things to be a lot worse than they actually will be. It's just, you know, councillors talk, different organisations do talk, we are aware, you know, people report to us when they're seeing problems, and we do, you know, we've even had one councillor who monitored the very first day we opened up everything. They were literally like, this is happening, and now it's calmed down. You know, we're watching, we're keeping, you know, as on it as we can, but we do need to time, basically, to just put some other things in place to make it that bit more safer or to have a few more powers. It might be that off-licences need to be looked at, but then, you know, there could be any number of things. I don't know if that would be as effective as people think, especially when we have a supermarket right next to the harbour. So,
no easy answers. Councillor Tia Roos, thank you very much indeed for talking to me today.
And that was Tia Roos, who represents the Malcolm Regis Ward on Weymouth Town Council. But we can't leave the subject there. John has talked to residents when visiting the harbour side in recent weeks. Takeaway menus from shop and cafe windows and gardens make a visit both inviting and toothsome, and coupled with the harbour's rich history, it's just what visitors want. It's hard to reconcile this welcoming scene with the excesses of what is called the nighttime economy. Someone whose views have been aired in the press recently is Dave Birchall of the Malcolm Regis community. What started as being an outspoken critic of the new railings has developed into a fear for the future of tourism in Weymouth. He wonders if the harbour area will become a no-go area unless yobbish behaviour can be curbed in some way. He gives us his views by telephone.
How is Weymouth changing? I mean, particularly on the harbour side these days. I've had reports of bad behaviour, and in fact, are things getting out of hand?
I think you're definitely right, John. I think that the whole ethos of our lovely town, which relies on tourism, with the changes that are being made around the harbour side, which have been completely done without any knowledge of our town councillors and our residents, are making it worse. And I don't actually know why, but it does seem that as the youngsters of today, where we used to go perhaps in smaller groups. They, maybe it's with Facebook or maybe with the electronic gadgetry that they say, oh, let's go out. And before you know it, there's not a couple. There's couples of dozens. We're talking about 30, 40, 50. And in fact, I've heard as many as 200 people who all get together. Then they're all getting their drinks. And where are they going to, what are they going to do? They're going to urinate in people's doorways and around the harbourside. It's making people's lives a misery. And for our tourism, heaven knows what's going to happen if this summer, when we are actually going to be away from lockdown, that we'll be in town and people are going to say, I'm never coming back to Weymouth again from what we see going on in the evening time. So I think we must be really worried. What we can do about it is another thing altogether, and I can only say that it is obviously a hot spot, so surely the police must know about it and must put extra patrols around there to cut it out.
I mean, I've had reports of people saying that they smell the unmistakable reek of cannabis. They talk about sort of mass drunkenness. I mean, has it got that bad?
Well, John, as I think, you know, it's a place where people would gather. We used to have it on the seafront, and then the police had certain orders where we banned certain people. But this seems to be just a group thing, and I'm just really worried that it's not just alcohol. As you say, drugs and alcohol seem to go together now, which they didn't in our day. And I can only see it getting worse. And I'm sure it's not just our lovely town. I'm sure it must affect other seaside towns.
What effect do you think the placing of these barriers is going to have on behaviour?
Well, I can only see them having a detrimental effect. I mean, the fact that we actually got rid of the railway line, which was a sort of historical link. As soon as you saw that, you knew you were in Weymouth. We're just becoming, could be any seaside town now. And it's the way that they're putting out the pubs now have got all their seating arrangements on one side. And now with the barriers on the wrong side of the wall, you can't even sit on the wall to have whether it's a pint or whether it's a pie or whether it's an ice cream. So we are just becoming very, very a normal place. And I just think the railings themselves, they're on the inside of the actual wall. People are just climbing on those now and sitting on them. I think that there's more danger. One of the problems that the county council or Dorset council said was for safety. I can only think they're making the matters worse, but that's my opinion.
Well, I've seen people sitting on the wrong side of the railings with their feet dangling over the harbour wall, of their railings sort of to their back, if you like.
That's exactly what we're seeing happening. And, you know, even youngsters, I mean, the favourite pastime there is with families doing their crabbing. And, you know, so you're basically leaning over and the parents are with them straight away. Now, I don't think the parents can actually get hold of the children because of the railings that are there. I thought they were going to be put on the outside of the wall, but anyway, that's another thing.
Now, you've been in the newspaper on a number of occasions talking about the Harbourside and things generally about Weymouth. I mean, where do you think the responsibility lies for making sure that, I mean, the law, I mean, actually you're not allowed to drink in the highway, but where do you think the responsibility lies and what's going to happen?
Well, I mean, we have only got, you know, the police and the people, the media, and people actually informing the police on what's going on. So I just feel that the pubs have a certain responsibility for this because they're open at that time. They can see what's going on. They don't want to see it happening because it's taking, people are not going to sit down there and have a meal and see what the yobs are doing. So I think they have a responsibility. And any of the harbour users, you know, that we have it's an active harbour. It's a real-life harbour. So they, the people on the boats and that, should have a responsibility to actually inform of what's going on, not to actually stop it, because I'm afraid that is, when you get 40-odd people and you get two policemen turn up, what are they going to do about it? I'm sorry.
Sounds to me as though Weymouth has to look in on itself, perhaps form a very, very solid pressure group to make sure that the harbour sort of reverts to what it should be. And well, the working harbour and a mixture of tourism. But
yeah, I think it's going to wreck up tourism. I really do. And it's not just the yobbos. I think during the daytime, with what's happened along Custom House Quay, I mean, that was always just, you went there and you knew you were in Weymouth because of, well, let's say the railway lines, but, you know, the way you were and the bridge going up. It's all part of it. But we're losing our identity, and that's the biggest problem I could see.
Well, thank you for talking so candidly, and I'll hope that by broadcasting this, somebody somewhere is going to take notice and do something. Thank you very much.
Well, John, I hope the same, and thank you for talking to me.
To close this report, I spoke to a number of residents living within a stone's throw of the harbour. Several mentioned the unmistakable smell of cannabis late at night, incontinent behaviour which necessitated the washing down of pavements and gutters in the morning. It is said the problem drinkers have migrated from the Esplanade, where the police have taken a strong line on drinking in public. Will walking along by the harbour in the evening become a thing of the past? Will it become a no-go area, as doorways are used as toilets? There's plenty for the town's leaders to think about as summer approaches. Problems are many and answers few, residents believe. And whose problem is it? Not ours, says Weymouth Town Council. Its control of the area disappeared with the setting up of the Dorset Council 2 years ago, which, as we have reported before, seems to have little regard for the needs of Weymouth.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine on Keep 106.
Let's change the subject completely. Trees and the felling thereof. Listeners to recent programmes have reported their concerns about the number of trees being felled alongside the railway tracks locally. Hundreds, thousands maybe, have disappeared, leaving the railway lines devoid of greenery. But before we shake the finger in disapproval at Network Rail, railway historian Paul Atterbury rises to its defence and explains trees on the railway land were never ever planned by the Victorian train companies who built the tracks. So how did they get there in such profusion?
Now let's delve into the history behind trees beside the railway tracks, because I may have got it wrong, because I was outraged when trees in my area alongside tracks were being chopped down a few weeks ago and said so. But Paul Atterbury has a different story and more of a historical take on the subject of railway trees. Paul, over to you.
Thank you. Well, as I say, coming at it from a historical point of view, when the railway lines were built throughout Britain, and of course in this area particularly, we're talking 1840s, 1850s, 1860s, trees were often planted on embankment sides and on the sides of cuttings to help stabilise the ground. But they were never planted close to the line. They never overhung the line. They were there purely for practical reasons. And built into the building of the railways, and actually which carried on for decades, well until the 1960s and beyond, was a maintenance schedule whereby trees were regularly pruned and cut back if they began to overhang or get too close to the line. And the reasons were very simple. We had obviously leaf fall. We all know about leaves on the line. Branches could drop on the track. Trees that were time expired or in storms could fall across the track, all of which was potentially very dangerous and could cause accidents. And so the line-side trees were always trimmed back as part of a regular maintenance schedule. I can remember as a child travelling on trains, and embankments were pretty clear, because I can remember one of the pleasures at this time of year was actually seeing railway cuttings rather than embankments, and sometimes embankments, completely covered with primroses, because, of course, there was no tree cover to stop them growing. And if you look at photographs of railways in our area taken up to 100 years ago, the trees are well back from the track. It was a matter of principle they were kept back. They were also kept back for visibility. The driver needed to see the signals, and encroaching foliage could make that harder. So it was all about maintenance and safety. And what happened, of course, with the increasing failure of proper support for the latter days of British Railways, well, I'm talking now the 80s and 90s, was that they simply didn't have the money to maintain that high level of tree cutting. And things began to slip, standards began to slip. And when the railways were privatised, everything went wrong, basically, as we know. But one of the things that disappeared completely was the sense that things like tree cutting and the maintenance of line-side growth was part of a regular maintenance schedule. You may remember, I'm sure you will, that before we had Network Rail, there was something called Railtrack. And Railtrack was a disaster from beginning to end. It was famous for its slipping standards, and indeed its lack of track maintenance was directly responsible for one or two quite major crashes in that period, which is why Railtrack disappeared and was replaced by Network Rail, which is has a fundamentally different attitude. And standards now are being caught up with. Backlogs of maintenance are being cleared. I'm a tree lover as much as you, but I'm aware that, you know, that what they're doing is catching up on years and years of neglect. We've also got to remember that some of those trees might have dated back to the 1860s and might simply have become too old to be left standing. This, again, is about woodland management. Whether it's railways or in a park, woodland has to be managed.
So it's a catching up process, then?
It's a catching up process. It's about standards or the qualities of build and repair work on stations is being carried out nationwide. There's a huge amount of backlog of maintenance now being taken out. Much of it, like the rebuilding of stations, is entirely visible. Things like cutting back trees that overhang or are too close to railway sides is something that one doesn't even notice. And yet it's a very expensive and necessary process.
I like your analogy about the primroses, because there is, in fact, a heritage railway line called the Primrose Line, isn't there?
There is, and that was it. That was in Sussex, I think. And it's a very distinct memory that I have of wandering on trains, I don't remember where, but in this area, through cuttings, obviously not so much on embankments, and just what my grandmother pointing out to me, the really dense growth of primroses and other wildflowers round the year, because there were no trees immediately close to the line.
I see. So is Network, or rather, it's Network Rail now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Are they planting trees at all?
Yes. They've been working closely with the Tree Council, and they have an ongoing project at the moment, which started at the end of last year, to plant 80,000 trees adjacent to or in land near railways. Network Rail, I think, is a very responsible body in many ways, and it tries to do things properly, and it has a green agenda, as it needs to, as we all need to. And I think, indeed, you know, there is a lot of pressure at the moment to make people understand that railways are actually do represent green transport, where, of course, cars don't. And Network Rail has very much got that in mind. At the moment, no one goes by train, but they're looking to the future to what sort of railway we will have in future years. And of course, with very few trains running, or relatively few trains running, this is a great time to catch up on a backlog of maintenance.
I see. Well, in fact, I think we've set the record straight, haven't we?
I think so. I mean, they are not just callously knocking down trees for the sake of it. They are catching up with trees which should have been looked after years ago in a maintenance sense.
I have to say, on a personal level, you know, I'm rather looking forward to the next time I go on a long train journey. I rather miss it.
Well, I miss it desperately. You know, it isn't that one is forbidden to do so, but you've got to have a jolly good reason to go on a train journey. And I did have a couple towards the end of last year through work, and in September, and it was a wonderful experience. I went up to Scotland, and this was for working on the roadshow, and I had a wonderful time, a wonderful couple of days, just sitting in a train, which was luckily quite empty, and watching the world go by. And I realised then how much I missed it. You know, I can't wait to get back on the rail again.
Well, we will share that experience. Thank you very much indeed for talking to Ridgway Magazine.
A pleasure.
Make, do and mend was a phrase born out of the Second World War, when on the home front there were shortages of everything, including clothing, which, like food and fuel, was rationed. In today's throwaway society, perfectly serviceable things get chucked. Or do they? This was brought home to John when he was out walking and saw an elderly gent pushing a large mobility scooter which had no seat. It had obviously seen better days. The pusher was called Dave Jones, and he explained he was going to do it up. It looked pretty tatty, having been standing outside a house for some time. It looked to be a difficult task, and imagine John's surprise when he saw Dave a few days later driving the refurbished scooter, complete with a new and a very comfortable-looking seat. "This," he explained, "is for a friend who can't get around. I'm doing up another I've been given for someone else who needs to get around, so I'm giving it to him." Make, do and mend, an example to us all. This good turn happened to coincide with a report by MoneySavingExpert.com. The publication asked subscribers about buying second-hand goods, from books to buggies. Researcher Ollie Townsend told us who was buying what.
Some fascinating research by MoneySavingExpert.com. It asks its public, what do you buy second-hand? And it had a lot of response. And I'm talking to Ollie Townsend, and he's going to tell me what the research threw up. I mean, first of all, it's cheap to buy second-hand. Of course it is. It's environmentally friendly. And some people think only new will do. But your subscribers told you something different, didn't they, Ollie?
Yes, they did. So we asked this question in our subscriber email, and it got a really good response from people. I think it shows how interested people are in the second-hand market now. Not everybody thinks, yeah, everything's got to be new. I think those two really key things and the key benefits of picking things up second-hand, like you mentioned, it's environmentally friendly, and I think people are much more obviously conscious of that at the moment. And it's cheap. And with the surge of online secondhand groups, it's becoming so much easier not only to do, but to see what bargains you can actually pick up. And often you can get stuff for free as well in your local area. So, you know, we were really sort of pleased to see the big response we got from it. And I think it was very interesting to look at what sort of things that people were buying secondhand. I mean, the most popular item that our users said that they'd be happy to pick up with secondhand were books. 86% of people overall said that they would buy secondhand books. And I think that's probably not a surprise, that one, because unless it's a book that you desperately want to keep, it's very common to pass it on to a friend or give it away by some other means, or indeed sell it. I mean, personally, me, I actually prefer an older book. I think there's sort of a brand new book, you want it to look a little bit old, I think, in a way. I think that's the one of the pleasures of having a book, really, is to know that it's been kind of read before. And a car or motorbike had the next largest number of people say that they'd buy second-hand. Cars, of course, they devalue considerably as they age. They always say, don't they, that the minute you drive the brand-new car off the forecourt, it already loses a lot of value. So I think there are things that people have probably been buying second-hand for many, many years now. But then, you know, you look at things like some more modern electronics and technology and things, items like DVDs and video games, things that you're likely only going to use once, perhaps. It's not something that needs to look pretty. As long as it works, then it's as good as new, really. And I think that's a key to this as well, is people don't want to throw things away anymore. They don't want things just sitting there, taking up room in their house. So people are selling things more. People are buying secondhand more because people are thinking, well, why pay more new when you don't need to?
Now, Ollie, I'm looking down the list of what people buy. One of the things which is very striking is that, in fact, women buy more second-hand goods generally than men. Quite amazing, because even thinking about cars, you know, 81% of women are instrumental in buying cars and motorcycles, and 81% of men also buy cars and motorcycles, particularly when they're younger. So what is this? Why is it that women are so prevalent in buying secondhand across the board, everything?
Yeah, it certainly does seem that way. And I think some of that probably stems from, you know, years ago, I think, you know, a lot of mothers would be sort of swapping baby clothes and baby toys and other things, because obviously, you know, babies grow out of these things very quickly. You don't want to be throwing them away. It costs money. So I think that the sort of secondhand, giving secondhand or even selling secondhand has been quite prevalent with mothers for years and years and years now. And so I think it's kind of expanded from that, really. And I think, you know, maybe this is generalizing, but I think probably women are quite often more conscious of money and sort of kind of a bit more aware of how much money that the household has got and how much is being spent. And so I think they probably got quite a good eye for a bargain, I think.
The other thing is, of course, women, if you like, have their own money these days, don't they? years ago, you know, the person who brought the money into the house was usually the man, and he would dish out the money to his family as they required it. These days, of course, so many women work and are responsible for the household budget. So possibly it's not surprising that, in fact, they have such a commanding view of where the money goes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you look at things that are on the secondhand market as well, so, you know, clothing, I think many would probably agree that women's clothing is probably a bit more interesting than men's. So I think you probably see a lot more of that on the secondhand market. Jewelry as well is something that, that you see on the secondhand market as well now. Wedding dresses even, and, you know, things like sort of baby clothes and buggies and toys and all of that. So I think it's I think it's to do with that as well is what there is out there. But I think it's just great to see that certainly overall, I think more people are interested in secondhand goods. They can see the value that they're getting in it, not just the sort of environmental benefit as well. And I think over the past year, certainly where people's budgets have probably got a bit tighter during the pandemic, I think the secondhand market is really going to grow and grow and grow. Charity shops especially, I think, obviously this time of year anyway, people are usually having their spring clean and going through and looking at what they can get rid of or sell on or take to the charity shop. And I think, you know, obviously they've just opened again recently, and I think people will be obviously taking a lot of their stuff there. And I think probably in a couple of weeks, I think there's going to be, I think the charity shops are going to be a bit of a treasure trove, really.
I think
over the coming months.
The thing is that there's no shame in buying secondhand. I mean, I noticed that, in fact, there are nearly 4,000 stores specializing in secondhand clothing, which is quite amazing, really, when you think about it.
Well, that's it. And sort of, you know, what's old is new again. You know, vintage is very trendy at the moment. So, you know, vintage clothing especially. Bizarrely, even clothing from the 90s is considered vintage now in some areas. I mean, we've seen, you know, you think of some of the big 90s bands, like a rare Nirvana t-shirt fetched £600 on eBay. It's quite amazing, really. So I think, yeah, that sort of, people are really kind of into, I mean, look at vinyl, you know, vinyl came back, and I think it's really interesting to see that actually sort of some older stuff is becoming trendy and popular again. And I think a lot of people want sort of the genuine kind of articles as well. I don't think people necessarily want modern things that look vintage. I think people do actually want, you know, the real things. And I think, you know, people are interested in kind of the stories behind items as well. So I think that all adds up to secondhand items becoming more and more popular.
Keep 106, your local radio.
Still with the subject, It must have been more than 30 years ago when one of the big charities, it might have been Oxfam, opened a shop in London selling second-hand clothing. Many at the time were very sniffy about the idea and said people would not, shall we say, steel themselves to the alien crutch. But they were wrong. The shop and 4,000 like it selling cast-offs have become big business, and not just for charities. Now, we love our fascinating facts here on Ridgeway Magazine, so here are some about the sales of second-hand fashion during lockdown. In the last year, the equivalent in size of 900 double-decker buses have been saved from landfill thanks to the sale of pre-loved items, according to journalist Danielle Whiteman-Stone. She reflects lockdown has given consumers more time to think about their shopping habits and has led to 12 million people buying pre-loved items in a six-month period last year. High-end fashion labels top the list, largely because people are turning towards more durable items of clothing which have design elements that were desirable in the past and still look good and interesting today, says eBay. It reports that in the first 6 months of last year, two pre-owned fashion items were sold through the site every second. The craze for sustainable fashion has gone global. Companies started up by young people cleaning out their wardrobes have turned into huge money spinners, reports the Sunday Times. The customers are largely 20-somethings looking for designer labels they could not possibly have afforded when new. And it's not just last year's fashions, no. These buyers are looking to buy into culture and history as expressed by clothing.
Andy and I have one thing in common. Neither of us has ever owned a pair of trainers, although I did once buy a pair of Go Faster Plimmies in an attempt to keep fit. But would you believe it if I told you trainers are the new collectibles, and there is a resale market for brand new trainers featuring old designs that the manufacturers are now rolling out but deliberately undersupplying, thus creating a demand. These designs, although new, are snapped up by people and resold at inflated prices, and we're talking hundreds of pounds. Collectors are willing to pay tens of thousands of pounds for rare Nike or Jordan trainers, and one London trader has sold them for up to £150,000 a pair. One wealthy client of a young London dealer, himself scarcely out of his teens, has a collection of 500 trainers displayed in wall-mounted Perspex boxes, and these are estimated to be worth over £1 million. So, could old trainers be a good run for your money? Have a look in the bottom of the wardrobe, and if you find, say, a pair of Air Jordan 10G Chicago trainers bought in 1985 for £47, they could be worth over £7,000 today.
Two topics for gardeners this time. Those of us fortunate to have bigger gardens will often have a part of it where nothing much will grow. Now, here our gardening expert talks first about a green initiative called No Mow May before tackling problem areas which might be both in shade and dry.
Hello, Ruth. We're going to start the programme slightly differently this time with an announcement from Weymouth Town Council, who have said that they will not be mowing, or not be mowing so much, during the month of May, and that they'll be letting certain areas in their parks and gardens grow wild. What do you make of that, Ruth?
Good morning, John. Good morning, everyone. I think it's a brilliant idea. Hats off to Weymouth Town Council. Yep, I think it's a fantastic, fantastic move. It's a brilliant initiative. I think it was originally launched by a charity called Plant Life, and they encourage people not to mow their gardens, not to mow their open spaces throughout May, just to give wild plants, you know, your daisies, your dandelions, buttercups, whatever you've got in your garden, give them a chance to grow, because they are so vital for our insects, for our pollinators, and also for the animals, the creatures that prey on the pollinators, whether they're insects like ground beetles and or things like spiders, birds, frogs, toads, you know, and going bigger upscale, or bigger upscale, that's not very good grammar, but, you know, things like hedgehogs. It's just really, really good for the natural ecosystem.
I've got something quite rare in my garden. We were talking last year about my minor bees.
Yes.
Bees live in the soil in the lawn. And they're very small, and they really are bees, and there are lots of them. Haven't seen them yet this year. But, I mean, are we not opening ourselves to getting our lawns covered in undisciplined weeds?
I think, do you know what, John? I think unless you want your lawn to look like a bowling green, I think 1 month really doesn't matter, and I think the benefits far outweigh the negatives. I would hugely recommend that for all gardeners to leave a little corner of your garden to grow wild. You know, don't keep it spick and span, pin tidy. You know, let it grow wild, and nature will thank you, you know, thousandfold.
Well, Ruth, I need no encouragement, because let's talk a bit about my bit of garden, which I find impossible to...
Mm.
It's very shady, it's dry.
Oh, yes.
And the thing is that it's not me, but it's the trees next door. And there's a very large and very beautiful weeping willow, which weeps all over that particular area. I'm at my wit's end. I can't seem to grow anything.
Dry shade is, I think, one of the trickiest areas of gardening, one of the trickiest combinations to get right and to choose what to plant there. But all isn't lost, John. All is not lost, so don't give up hope. What you need to do, first of all, is dig over the soil and dig in lots of really well-rotted sort of compost. If you make your own, use that. If you don't, use soil improver or peat-free multi-purpose compost. Manure is also very good. Dig that in, and that will improve the soil, but it will also help it to hold on to moisture.
Right, okay. I mean, at the moment, the only thing that grows there, of course, abundantly, are certain types of weeds. They need no encouragement at all. Where on earth are they getting their moisture from?
Weeds are little blighters. Weeds will thrive come what may. They're probably weeds that like shady, dry conditions, you know, that perhaps grow in the wild, would grow underneath hedgerows, in woody areas. Weeds need very little to survive. They will take everything they can and thrive on it. You know, probably come the end of the world, there will still be weeds. You know, so they just thrive. It's what they do. It's how they survive, you know.
Well, then let's get back to the kind of soil treatment.
Mm.
So, I mean, the garden centre is just up the road, so I can buy some bags of compost.
Yeah.
Said peat-free, did you?
Always use peat-free. Always use peat-free, yes.
Do you have a sort of brand name or a variety that I should look for?
Well, Westland are very good. Westland do a peat-free compost called New Horizon.
Yes.
Which is very good. And then there's an RHS-approved compost called Silver Grow, S-Y-L-V-A Grow, if my memory serves me, which is, again, peat-free, very good.
Now, I'm a budget gardener, so if I go to my garden centre, I am confronted by lots of different bags of compost at lots of different prices.
Yes.
What do I get if I want a budget?
I think it's hard to say. I mean, I would go, very often garden centres do deals. Like my local garden centre here up in Dorchester has, you know, 3 bags for £18, 3 bags for £20. Do that, go for those, but please always get peat-free. It works just as well as compost with peat. You're helping the environment, you're helping save the planet. But yeah, look for the special offers. And don't go very cheap, because, you know, you get what you pay for.
Okay, so I've dressed the soil, I've been quite generous with compost. I've now got the problem of what to plant.
Do you know, there are a lot of plants that you can grow that will thrive in dry shade. There's several shrubs. I would perhaps think something like a mahonia, which is a lovely dark green, has lovely dark green leaves and stunning yellow flowers.
Can you spell that for us?
M-A-H-O-N, N for nuts, I-A, Mahonia.
And is that a plant with a flower?
It has a lovely yellow flower, and it's great for bees. It's a beautiful flower.
And is it tall or short, or is it crab cover?
They come in all different, loads of different varieties, but all garden centres will sell them. They're very popular, they're very common.
Okay, what about ground cover? I mean, I always think in terms of vinca. I've got that.
Yeah, vinca is good. Vinca is very good for shady areas. Lady's mantle is also good, which has those lovely open leaves that catch raindrops. It has pretty little green flowers. And if you're looking for colour, something like aquilegias, you could sow or plant aquilegias. There are so many different varieties. And they will sell seed, so you'll get lots of them.
Can you spell that as well, please?
Yes, A-Q-U-I-L-E-G-I-A.
Right.
And you can buy them as seeds or buy them as plants. They're everywhere. Another lovely one is begonia, which is B-E-R-G-E-N-I-A. They're also known as elephant's ears. They have huge, great green, fleshy leaves, really pretty pink flowers in a variety of shades. And they're happy there as well.
What one is looking for is colour throughout the summer and into autumn.
Yeah.
Would you say that you should plant a variety of these sort of plants, or do they flower for a long time?
I mean, some of them will flower for a long time, but then you can also, you know, see what there is. See, they will flower sort of through the summer into the autumn. You could also go for something like Heuchera, which is H-E-U-C-H-E-R-A, which have lovely delicate white flowers, but they come in a huge variety of the different coloured leaves, you know, greens, reds, yellows. And their leaves stay all year round. They're evergreen, and they're good for ground cover as well. And they really are stunning.
As always, Ruth, good advice. And thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure, John. Thank you.
Our next item is about Weymouth Town Council and its programme through which it supports local charities to the tune of about £30,000 a year. All a good cause has to do is apply and put forward its case. Weymouth Town Councillor David Gray puts us in the picture with details of how to apply. It's a rolling programme, so there is no cut-off date.
Weymouth Town Council has got money to give away to small charities, and here to explain the initiative is Councillor David Gray. So over to you.
Yes, thank you, John. So grants are available through Weymouth Town Council grant scheme with the aim of benefiting sort of worthy community groups, volunteer groups, charitable organisations in the local area. We've set aside some money this year for people to apply. If you go onto the Weymouth Town Council website, look under grants application, you'll be able to download and fill in the application. And that's considered by the finance group and awarded accordingly, providing, you know, all the rules are met in terms of how we distribute the money.
Well, let's talk about some of the rules then, because I'm sure people listening will be very interested in this, because it's a rolling fund. There's no cut-off date, is there?
No, there isn't, no.
So what are the rules? What are you looking for?
Well, I suppose the biggest one would be that this is aimed at the community, so not-for-profit would be the first thing. So generally not a profit-making organisation, so a community group, probably locality wise it has to be in Weymouth, obviously, and for the benefit of the majority of Weymouth residents. So if it strays outside, then we apply some sort of percentage, but generally it's for residents of Weymouth.
You've got about £30,000 to give away, or is it rather more than that? Because it's a rolling fund, isn't it?
It's a rolling fund, yeah. We've set aside up to £50,000 this year. We spent, of last year's pot, I think we spent something like £35,000. Don't quote me on that, but that's roughly what we spent. So a new fund appears every year if we can afford it, and we like to support a wide range of local community groups in their endeavours.
Now, when I was talking to you just before I pressed the button for the microphone, you were talking about painting.
Yes, well, we had an interesting application at the last meeting, which was from, well, two applications actually. One was from the Friends of the Marsh. They wanted to repaint the basketball courts at the Marsh, repaint the tarmac, tidy the area up. They needed some special paint for that. So that's exactly the type of local organisation, charity organisation for the benefit of the local community that we like to support.
I think
that was an interesting one.
I think they had to have found about £1,500 for that project.
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was under the £2,000 limit, but it was probably £1,500 to £1,600, I think, that they needed, and that was pretty much to buy the special paint that they need to do it with. And I think linked to that, there's a proposal for the local children from Budmouth College to get involved in the project. So now we've funded the capital expenditure, we can get local students involved in bringing up, you know, investing in their some of their facilities, which is a great idea.
So does
the other painting one we had was the old town hall. So Selwyn came along to talk to us about the fact that it's obviously Weymouth's 450th anniversary this year, and part of the project was to restore some parts of the old town hall, and he needed some money to repaint the historic railings, which we provided. So that was about £1,500 as well.
I think you also helped the Bowls Club, didn't you?
Yes, we did, yes. The Bowls Club, Weymouth Bowls Club, right on the Green Hill there, they provide toilets, outside toilets, toilets for members of the public as well. They needed some repainting, and they need a couple of fixtures in there. So we provided just under 2,000, I think, to, don't quote me on that, but it's under the 2,000 limit to upgrade those. So they were very grateful. And, you know, there's a significant part of the population that enjoy Bowls and Green Hill in general. It's a worthy cause.
And we've come to the end of another edition of Ridgeway Magazine. In our next programme on the 12th of May, we're going to examine the tyranny of the password. How many do you have? Ever forgotten one? And guess what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 and Manchester United, as in Manchester UTD, are among the most used and most easily broken. So, hope you can join us for that next time. But for now, from John Shepherd and me, Andy Venton, do take care of yourselves, and cheerio!